As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Welcome to the Total Soccer Show Weekend Review! After Jude Bellingham bagged a goal that was vital, Real Madrid are dead certs to win the Spanish title. We were treated to a goal-packed Clasico, and who would have thought Lucas Vazquez would end up being the star of the show? Elsewhere, Coventry almost had a historic day when Man United gave a 3-goal lead away. Hudji Wright kept the Sky Blues dreaming before a Hoyland penalty did the job of redeeming. For Erik ten Hag, it wasn't big and it wasn't clever. It might have been the most embarrassing win ever. Elsewhere, Man City ensured another derby final in the FA Cup and Bayer Leverkusen kept their undefeated shtick up. My name's Ryan Bailey. Joining me today, Power Trio once again, ladies and gentlemen, led by Mr. Taylor Rockwell. Hello, Taylor.
Hello, Ryan Bailey. I loved that introduction and hated it simultaneously. Well done to you, Sarah Doff of the Cap. I thought of you fondly this weekend, Ryan. Would you like to know why?
Is it PG?
It is. I was playing in our adult league here in Richmond, our Sunday league, and there was a midfielder for the other team wearing purple shorts, and that was not what drew me to him. It was the crest on those purple shorts because it was Wimbledon. Yes, sir. There's the gasp. And so I said, is that Wimbledon on your shorts? And he said, oh, good knowledge. And what I was struck by, the reason why I'm bringing this up, is to ask you a question. He had the exact same accent as you, which makes me wonder, is there a Wimbledon accent? Do you get that in that area? Or is it more so just a loose conglomeration of different accents?
Actually, it's just standard English how it's supposed to be spoken, so we prefer it to claim that it's accentless, actually.
Yes, it's just English, Taylor. How did I not see this coming? Of course. He did say, good on you for knowing that they exist, to which I respond, yeah, I have a friend who won't shut up about them. It was pretty much how I responded, and that was a nice way to begin that game. Yeah, there you go.
You're referring to me in that instance.
I was. Amazing. I didn't feel like getting into, I do a podcast with a guy, like, in the middle of a game when I think a goal kick was about to be taken. And you good are a friend, stuff. So it all works out.
Oh, lovely. Yeah. Very nice, Taylor. Thank you for that. Joe Lowry also with us. Hi, Joe. How was your weekend?
It was Wimbledon shortless. That's for sure. I was going to make fun, Ryan, of you for your continued insistence that anything north of London in England is garbage, et cetera, et cetera, until you said that thing about the accent, which is exactly how I feel about the Arizona accent, which I genuinely believe is the most neutral accent in the United States, at least the Southwest. Maybe we can toss in Colorado and Utah into this. But I honestly think that is the purest form of American English. Come fight me.
Is that why is that?
I'm too
Joe?
Busy laughing at that suggestion to want to fight you.
Because we don't have the drawl of the South. We don't have whatever's going on in the Northeast. We don't have the Valley Girl that California has to claim as their own. Like, I don't know. There's just none of that. We don't have the Midwest like egg sound instead of the ag that everybody else uses. It's just pure. It's just clean American English, guys.
So bland is what you're saying.
Sure. But, I mean, that's also what you were saying. So, you know, there's that. Ryan, unrelated to all this stuff, how did Charlotte FC let you back in front of the supporter section? Playing your air guitar? It was a real guitar, folks, not an air guitar. I'm still advocating for the keytar, but Ryan, why don't you toss that explainer out there?
Oh, yeah, sure. So the Charlotte FC game this weekend, for some reason I was invited back to play some guitar at halftime.
Because you're good at guitar. I will say it for you, since you are too humble to say it. You're very good at guitar, and you sound quite good doing it.
Thanks.
And you have a really nice voice, too. Like, you have one of those singing voices that is jarring at first because it sounds so little like your talking voice. In a pleasant way, you have a nice talking voice, too. But there are people like that who, like, you'll hear their voice, and you'll be like, oh, I can imagine how they're going to sing, and then they sing, and it's either much higher or much lower than you expect. Ryan Bailey's is like that, but in a pleasing way. So, Okay. Credit to you, Ryan. Less credit for wearing the Inner Miami pink, which you appear to still be wearing at time of recording. So apparently you're just a spokesperson for them now.
I am, yeah. I like pink, Taylor. I like pink, but I'm very uncomfortable with all this flattery, so we're going to move on very quickly. No Graham Rutherford on this episode. He's still in Florida giving vast quantities of his disposable income to Walt Disney Company. Hope you're having fun.
Even more flattery for you, Graham Rutherford not being here. There you go.
We miss Big G, don't we? We hope he's back in the house soon. He will be indeed. Patreon.com/Total Soccer Show if you'd like to support our endeavor. Thank you very much to everyone who does so. Those people who do so get bonus podcasts, including Weekend Review Extra, coming on the feed today. Also bonus videos and access to the Discord where all the cool kids are hanging out. Alrighty, why don't we start our show today with El Clasico. Real Madrid 3, Barcelona 2. Jude Bellingham with the late winner as Real Madrid came from behind twice at the Bernabeu. Bernabeu now with the SoFi Stadium style screens around the roof now. Looking pretty sharp in there. Very nice.
It's a nice facelift.
Very modern. Nice facelift indeed. So Barcelona's last hope of a trophy is gone. Real Madrid now 11 points clear, all but certain to secure the Spanish title. Taylor, I wasn't expecting us to come into this. There's a few talking points in this, but one of the talking points I'd like to highlight is, as I mentioned in the intro, Lucas Vazquez being basically the main character of this game, involved in all three Real Madrid goals. I didn't see that one being the theme of Real Madrid's
no.
game.
No, Lucas Vazquez, who the joke on TSS has been that I always think he's like 24 years old and have for the last maybe 15 years. I don't know how old he is now, but
he
I will
forever
think he is
32 years old,
there
which
you
is
go.
Breaking my brain, Taylor. Right? What on earth?
Right? But here he is in all of his veteran nous coming in and making things happen, including maybe drawing a penalty, earning a penalty instead of maybe being fouled, but credit to him for that, and then it's a lovely finish as well. Yeah, I did not have him being the star of this game, though even with that performance, I do think, per your introduction, Jude Bellingham probably comes away as the overall star. The moment of him sort of celebrating in front of the Bernabeu and rotating a little bit did feel mildly iconic on the weekend.
Oh, yeah, I did like that. There were some good celebrations. One of the Barcelona scorers sort of jumped over the hoardings. I can't remember which one it was now. And sort of goaded the Real Madrid fans as well. That was a risky move too. Yeah. But yeah, Jude Bellingham does love to score in a Clásico, Joe. Scored twice, of course, in the return fixture in Barcelona earlier this season for that 2-1 win. Ballon d'Or, baby. It's a coming.
It feels really possible. What did I say last week? I said that whoever wins the Champions League of Erling Haaland, Kylian Mbappe, and Jude Bellingham probably going to end up with the Ballon d'Or. Of course, I'm so passionate about the Ballon d'Or, which is a completely logical and important award that means so much to so many. Jude Bellingham in this game was fantastic, and that's no surprise. I still can't get over how Carlo Ancelotti in the year 2024 has gone full on, let's put as many central midfielders on the field as we possibly can. Everybody else is doing center backs these days. Ancelotti's doing central midfielders. Basically six of them, maybe five and a half if we don't count Fede Valverde as a full on central midfielder. I'm kind of happy to, but either way, it's Camavinga playing left back in this game, makeshift left back. It's Tchouaméni playing next to Rudiger at center back. And then you've got Valverde, Luka Modric, Toni Kroos, and Jude Bellingham all in the midfield sort of area. And then you're looking at not really a pure number nine, because that's been Real Madrid's thing this year too, between Rodrigo and Vinicius Jr. up top. And it just keeps working. And a huge part of why it works so well so often is because Jude Bellingham has really perfected this like 10.5, 9.5, 8.5 role where he's doing a little bit of everything. And the goal that he scores, the late winner, which is incredibly fitting after he does the exact same thing back in the first edition, Ryan, as you mentioned, of El Clasico this year, it feels just so fitting that he would score this goal in the way that he scores it. He makes the run towards the back post on the weak side of the box. He makes the run that doesn't get rewarded every time, or even most of the time, but every once in a while, the ball trickles through. And that's exactly what happens in this moment for Real Madrid. Play progresses, and it comes in from the right side. Bellingham's making the run down the left. And he makes the run, hoping not knowing but hoping that the ball is going to make its way through to him. And it does. In that moment is a huge one for Real Madrid because it gets them 3 points from this game. It puts them pretty much in the catbird seat that nobody else is going to be catching in the league. Jude Bellingham has been so unbelievably good at making basically that exact same run, whether it's on the weak side or whether it's through the center of the box waiting for an aerial cross. That is such a skillful part of his game, is the off-ball movement and the understanding of space.
Yeah, one of the controversial incidents, Taylor, the VAR and or the lack thereof, I suppose, on one of the potential goals that Barcelona thought they scored. Xavi unhappy about this situation, couldn't prove that Yamal
was
crossed the line. Yeah, he apparently it's a thing that he gets a bit angry on the sidelines these days. Who'd have thunk it?
Who'd have thunk indeed?
Yeah. So we don't have goal line technology in La Liga, which was a big surprise to Steve McManaman on the comms, because he was like, do we not have this? Why are they not doing this? He
so
was
real, though. Why on earth is there no goal line technology?
So it appears, Joe, that there was goal line technology, or at least it was sanctioned for La Liga, but Javier Tebas had it removed because it was too expensive.
Nice. Yeah. I mean, I said in the pre-show, just La Liga's got to make sure they've got enough money to cover up things that they need to cover up and put out PR campaigns that they need to put out. I mean, got to do what you got to do.
Yep. Money's got to be funneled in certain directions, I suppose, Joe. We should move on from that. Looking at some of the research, apparently for the Bundesliga, the Hawkeye system they use for goal line technology apparently costs €8,000 per match per stadium. Which seems like a lot. I feel like TSS could get like some laser pointers and like set it up. A few hundred bucks, I'd do that at any stadium.
Nah, you're definitely shining that laser directly in the referee's eye, right? Nobody's giving you a laser pointer.
I mean, I'm not defending Tebas, but 8,000 seems like a lot for that to be set up per game. I guess it's a licensing thing or whatever. But yeah, Taylor, we have seen some evidence to suggest the ball did cross the line, some that suggest it didn't. Do we want to have this conversation about ball crossing a line?
No, I mean, other than just to say it's definitely a controversial point, Barcelona saying that if they can prove definitively it did, that they will request a replay. That feels a little bit like trying to mollify their fans and sort of spark the outrage at the same time to distract from the fact that they lost a Clásico and probably lost the title again and are going to be without a manager and have, what, 6 games left with a manager who's not going to be there, with a squad that probably needs some changing, with a lot of uncertainty. And so it feels like stoking that ire might be the way to avoid some of those difficult conversations for a little bit of time. It does feel silly that there isn't goal line technology. That feels like one of those things where they're pleading poverty, but at the same time, probably not slashing bonuses and not probably slashing other areas. But that's one where we can get by, because whatever, if a ball crosses the line, what's the worst thing? No one's going to care. And now here we are. So yeah, once again, Javier Tebas, maybe not the best person. I'll go ahead and say that one. In terms of this game, though, I thought there were other more interesting talking points, though that is the dominant one. I thought it was pretty fascinating that both teams seem to have watched a good amount of footage of the opposition. That's maybe not surprising, given who these clubs are and the importance of this fixture. But in terms of Andre Lunin in goal, not covering himself in glory, especially with the first one, which is sort of an in-swinging cross. He comes for it, but it's in traffic. He doesn't get a hand to it. Andreas Christensen heads it in. And this seems to be a thing that teams have spotlighted. It seems like a thing that Manchester City were going for, was basically putting in an in-swinging cross and making him have to decide if he's coming for it or not, but then putting bodies around him to limit that, because I think the idea is that he's maybe not as assertive as he needs to be when coming for those crosses. He's not barreling through people. He's a little bit hesitant, and so you can catch him there, and Barcelona did. I also felt like he did not do a particularly good job for the second goal, where he makes a save, but he parries it right back into the path of an attacker. That was pretty poor. But then the clip that I am now fascinated by, that's been doing the rounds, is the Barcelona conceding in this game in almost identical fashion to the way they conceded against PSG. Like, it's wild. It's both teams, Real Madrid and PSG, having possession centrally, playing it wide to an open player on the left who takes a touch, hits a bending cross into the back post where there's a wide open player there to finish. A lot of that has to do with the commonality of João Cancelo, but also has to do with the way Barcelona are setting up and maybe being too narrow and not being able to apply pressure in time. And so it felt like both of these teams had watched a lot of tape, had a lot of familiarity with each other, and knew how to exploit vulnerabilities. And then Real Madrid just had the difference makers that were necessary to elevate that performance to a win.
Indeed. The win does extend Real Madrid's unbeaten record in all competitions to 28 matches, winning 22 and drawing 6. Joe, they very good at soccer. Anything more on this Clásico game before we move on?
I'll toss one more thing for Barcelona because, let's be honest, there's not a lot of reason for us to go deep, deep, deep on them and on their specific games as the year continues from this point forward. So I do want to do one more thing on them, which is to spotlight Lamine Yamal, which is not a unique thing to do at this point in 2024. But I still cannot get over how effective he's been at such a young age on the wing for them. The talent is so incredibly obvious. And the thing that really crystallized for me in this game is not his overall ability. It's not his straight line speed, which is very real and very effective. It's not his vision, which is the exact same. It's not his ability to execute with that left foot. It's not the fact that he has a very strong weak foot as well, left foot dominant, but capable of driving to the end line and cutting it back on his right foot. We saw all of that in this game. And he plays that bending ball into the box with his left foot that Lunin can't quite parry wide. And it is a difficult moment for Lunin. He doesn't have great sight line on it, but still does not handle that exceptionally well. And Lamal is a huge part of that goal sequence for Barcelona. Yep. It's none of that stuff, though, to be honest. It's thinking about how well he fits in the modern game. You know, Lamine Yamal is a winger who likes to have his feet very, very wide. He likes to have his feet on the sideline, on that right wing, able to cut inside on his left foot, able to use his right foot to get to the end line. That is something we're seeing more and more, like almost the return of the traditional winger, at least in terms of spacing, if not in terms of, you know, whether they like to cut in on their inside foot or their outside foot. You know, his ability to stay wide and create space for players in the half space is something that it feels like every manager around the world wants right now. Think about what we see with Manchester City and how Pep Guardiola uses his wingers, even if they are more traditional, like half-space guys. We'll talk about Man City later on. It was Jack Grealish and Bernardo Silva, but they were staying super, super wide for Manchester City to try and stretch the opposing back line out as much as possible to create space in the seams between individual opposing defenders. Lamal is so good at that stuff at 16. Like, the guy hasn't finished high school, and he's doing some of this stuff. I think he is a really, really sharp fit for basically any elite ball-dominant team. Barcelona, maybe not elite relative to some of the other top teams in Europe, but they still fit that bill. And Lamal is a huge part of that. He fits so well on that right wing.
Yeah, Joe, you've laid it out really well there. I would just add, he's like a panic inducer, is what I'm going to call him. That he is a player for Barcelona that can, with the ball at his feet, just strike panic into defenders and make them make silly mistakes. He embarrassed Eduardo Camavinga a few different times in this game. As you said, Joe, he is more naturally a central midfielder. We've seen him play left back. I wouldn't say he's a defensive left back by any stretch of the imagination. And in this performance, Yamal also almost earns a penalty. He gets dragged back by Camavinga, like, just outside the box. Camavinga gets a yellow card for it. There were some shouts there that maybe that could have been a red, but I think it was pretty well covered and it was a tighter angle. But all that to say that Yamal just is that player who can make a difference, who can take people on, who can make defenses make stupid mistakes or stupid decisions. And I think probably would have loomed even larger heading into this game had he not been the sacrificial player in the second leg against PSG when he has to come out because of the red card to Araujo. Comes out in the 34th minute, and I do wonder if they'd been at full strength with him sort of going at defenses or attacking open spaces as PSG tried to make something happen in that game. Maybe he would have come into this Clásico with a few more goals to his name, and it would have been an even bigger performance. But I do think that is very much a silver lining if you're a Barcelona fan, the potential of Yamal, and even Cubarsí, who does concede the penalty, but I think that was more unfortunate for him, and maybe it was a learning experience. He's also a teenager. He leaves that leg out. Lucas Vázquez makes that contact. I see why it's given as a penalty. It's usually given as a penalty. It could have felt harsh in the moment, but I think there are some reasons for optimism if you're a Barca supporter. A few more if you're a Real Madrid supporter, though.
Yeah. Plenty of reasons for optimism for Barcelona. Hey, the sun's going to come up tomorrow, right, Taylor? It's all good.
As long as they pull that lever.
As long as they keep pulling those levers. One dagger for Barcelona, by the way. I don't know if you noticed, guys. There were advertisements for Shakira's new song on the advertising boards around the goals.
That feels deliberate.
Yeah. At the Bernabeu. I don't know if... I would like to think that Shakira was personally involved in that placement. That would please me.
But I would be surprised if she weren't, or if her PR people weren't like, yeah, we're definitely doing that, and we're going to make a statement, and I wonder if they paid extra to make that happen. And if they did, good on them. That's hilarious.
Bravo, indeed. And well done to Real Madrid on their Clásico victory. We take a quick break now. When we come back, FA Cup Madness back shortly.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Total Soccer Show, welcome back to our weekend review. Let's go to Wembley Stadium where the FA Cup semi-finals took place. We almost, I'm going to call it a classic, not almost an all-time classic, Taylor. Coventry 3, Man United 3, Man United going through 4-2 on penalties. I suppose classic is a relative term, depending on which team you like.
But, well, I thought we were leading with Man City-Chelsea, and I was like, you thought that was a classic? But now I understand. Now I understand.
I feel like this is the one to lead with, frankly, Taylor, given the events that happened. Of course, Man United giving up a 3-goal lead. Coventry had a goal disallowed in extra time that looked like it was going to give them a 4-3. Another Man United 4-3 loss looked like it was on the cards, but one of the heroes of Coventry's team, of course, Hudgy Wright, Los Angeles, California's Hudgy Wright, we should say, with the 95th minute penalty to force extra time. There's some nice video footage of Man United fans leaving Wembley. I don't know if you guys have seen it, but then they're all streaming back in when they realise there is more soccer to be played in this game. Erik ten Hag admitting afterwards.
Wait,
that
sorry, they thought it was going to be a 3-3 draw and everybody just goes home, or I'm. What?
I think they were 3-2. They were like, we're packing up. We're going to beat the traffic.
Gotcha. Thank you for
and
clarifying.
They decided to come back because Coventry almost turned it. And Erik ten Hag seemed acutely aware of that, saying his side got away with it. This was, Taylor, the 2-year anniversary of Erik ten Hag being announced for this team. Look how far we've come.
Yeah. Look how far we've come indeed. FA Cup final, 2 years in a row. He's pretty proud of that one. He mentioned that 5 or 6 different times when he was under pressure with a lot of the questions being asked of him after this result. I was listening to the Talk of the Devils podcast, and they were also mentioning that a lot of the press box vacated when it looked like it was going to finish 4-3, and then a lot of them ended up watching the shootout from various positions as they realized the game was ongoing. But this did feel like it was going to end in a Manchester United loss. It certainly didn't when they were up 3-0, and it's a credit to Coventry that they have the fight back that they did. I do want to say Manchester United definitely took their foot off the gas and then definitely looked panicky. And for a team in, what, 7th or 8th in the championship to recognize there's an opportunity here, maybe they listen to the show and they know from Graham Ruthven that if you score 1 against Manchester United, you get 2. And in this case, I guess you get 3. But they pressed. They made life difficult. They were certainly the dominant team in the second half. They had more of the ball, more of the opportunities, were controlling the match, and I think probably deserved to win if, as their manager said, if Hudgy Wright had trimmed his toenails, maybe he would have been onside and this would have gone a different way. Definitely not throwing him under the bus because that is the most marginal of offside calls possible, and he does get the equalizing penalty. He scores his penalty in extra time. So a good performance from him, a very strong performance from Coventry. The opposite of that for Manchester United, who once again have lots of questions being asked of them and their manager and some of the individuals. Many of the Manchester United decision makers were in attendance for this one, so I think got to see firsthand what United look like once they start to panic and how little answers or few answers they had. And the most like rough example of this is Jim Ratcliffe, who was running the London Marathon, so showed up for the second half. Credit to him, 71 years old, finishing it in 4.5 hours. Yeah. Ryan, is that a good time?
Insane marathon time for a 71-year-old. I mean, that's feels like a good marathon time regardless, but for 71, that's crazy.
I think that's a flex to run a marathon and then show up for the team you own's second half at Wembley. I like that.
I don't know if you can, right? I don't know if you can monitor endorphins, but it would have been fascinating to do some sort of analysis of him after finishing that marathon, showing up at the stadium. Here we go. We're up 3-0. Life is good. And then the second half happens, but then you win in a shootout. I don't know how he ended up, but I'm not sure how Erik ten Hag ends up after all of this, because it was certainly not a convincing win by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah, obviously, it's worth noting that the FA Cup semi-finals are held at Wembley for financial reasons, basically to pay for Wembley Stadium from when it was constructed. They try and hold as many games there as possible. This game should have been at Coventry, where they wouldn't have had VAR. So if this game was held at Coventry, that 4-3 would have stood, technically. offside goal wouldn't have been pulled back in extra time. So that's something to think about potentially. And it does show sort of the slight unfairness of this competition where some stadiums have VAR and some do not. It's not quite a level playing field in the FA Cup. That's worth noting.
I blame Javier Tebas for that as well.
Yeah, me too. It's far too expensive to have it in every single stadium up and down England. Anyway, Joe, coming back to Erik ten Hag, I'm getting a bit sick of him blaming injuries every time his team is extremely poor. With all the injuries, he said, we don't have many tools. We don't even have a back four in their best position. Yes, sure, Manchester United have injuries. They're not the only team in the world that has injuries. I just don't buy it as an excuse for what is going on at Manchester United, where it appears he has lost the dressing room recently, if not a while ago.
Yeah, I think it would be wrong to characterize injuries as the only problem for Manchester United. But let's not lie. Like, they are obviously a real, real problem. To see Casemiro start in the back line is a troubling sign. You can go down the depth chart and you've got...
I would make that just to see Casemiro start at this point.
Yeah,
but sure, well,
that's,
go ahead.
That's fine. And that gets to a different problem, though, that I'll get to in a second. Like, injuries are a very real issue for this team. You're looking at Martinez on the bench, you're looking at Shaw on the bench, you're looking at Rafa Varane on the bench. Like, you can go through the whole list. They're missing, like, four or five players who would probably be ahead of Casemiro on the center-back depth chart. The other problem, though, that I think is very, very real for this team that I've talked about over and over and over again is the fact that the top-end talent just isn't there. Like, the top-end talent isn't there. The quality depth isn't there. None of their attacking players would start for any of the teams that are really pushing for the Premier League title or for a Champions League trophy. Like, it's just not there right now for this Manchester United team. That doesn't excuse them dropping three goals in the second half, where they were dominant in the first half, truly, and as they should be against a team like Coventry City. They only allowed one shot in the first 45 minutes of this game. It was a free kick. It was blocked. Like, they were dominating the ball. They were dominating chances. They were dominating field position. In the second half, it was always going to switch because of the game state. When you're up 3-0, there's almost always going to be this natural easing off the gas that happens, and I don't always think that's a bad idea. But Manchester United then just couldn't get control of the game after they had the nice defensive breakdown from Diogo Dalo and Casemiro that leads to the first goal. Dalo's pointing at Casemiro to pick up Sims, and he just never does it. And all of a sudden, Ellis Sims has a nice little goal in the back of the net, and there's life for Coventry City. But man, the more and more we talk about this team, and make no mistake, we've talked a lot about this team that's sitting seventh place in the Premier League right now. Like, the more and more we talk about them, just the more clear it becomes to me that their quality is not there to the point where you feel good about controlling leads against basically anybody. And that could be a team that's towards the top of the championship. Again, the championship. Or that could be a team that's actually in the Premier League. Like, this Manchester United team is broken in a lot of ways. It's not like they can't be fixed at some point. But that point is not in 2024.
Joe, you may have just answered it there with the issues with Manchester United's quality. But when you talk about easing off due to the game state when you're up 3-0, a lot of people, most of them with like Manchester United flares on their Reddit accounts, have suggested that against an opponent who is perceived to be of lesser quality, put it that way, that you don't ease off, that you kind of kill the game off, you win 5 or 6-0, you don't put your foot on the ball, you don't slow it down. Would you disagree with that idea? Do you feel like there is a moment when, especially if you do have the injuries they do, you do just try to kind of see out the game, control it, and win comfortably, but not emphatically?
I don't, Taylor, I really don't know that I would categorize it as, like, you do this against good teams and you do this against teams that are inferior to you, right? I think so much of this is situational. In this game for Manchester United, I absolutely do not blame them for easing off ever so slightly and banking on your ability to defend a little bit against a team that is an entire league below you. So I don't know. I just am not sure I have a great answer to that question because I don't think that it's quite that simple.
I think you've answered it well, and again, I hear you. I don't want to go too long on Manchester United. I will say I'm a Manchester United supporter for anyone who's new, which is why we tend to go long on them. So I apologize in advance. But Joe, I think what you said there is the key thing, is that when you're up 3-0 against Coventry or whomever, there is an idea that let's back our defense to get the result. Let's back our goalkeeper and our defenders and our midfielders to do what they need to do to see this game out. And that has not been the case for this team. And I think that is the biggest knock on Erik ten Hag at this moment as I see it. Because I think some of this is the locker room, some of this is injuries, but a few things from a very good Athletic piece about Man United. Since the quarterfinal against Liverpool, United have given up a 1-0 lead, a 3-2 lead, a 2-1 lead, and 3-0 leads. Ten Hag has seen his players concede 7 goals in the 90th minute or beyond since the start of February. That is the worst result, basically, or worst series of results since 1962, and they only have 3 points from their last four league games. So it does feel like a team that is incapable of seeing out that lead. And so you're correct that that makes sense and should be a thing they can do. It feels like a thing they're not capable of. And then when you have Erik ten Hag looking absolutely frozen when it was 3-3 and looked like it was going to be 4-3, it doesn't spell confidence, I guess. So I think it will continue to be a hazy situation for Manchester United supporters as we approach the end of the season.
I want to flip the script here. Let's do a bit on Coventry because they were
let's
so much
that.
Fun
yes,
in the
please.
Second half.
Yes,
like
please.
They come out of this game, they're in this 5-4-1 shape, and just their ability to get back into this game is so incredibly impressive. This is a similar story. Like, we've seen this sort of story for Coventry City in the FA Cup already, and we've seen a lot of it circling around Haji Wright. Obviously, Taylor, you're talking about you're a Manchester United fan. We spend a lot of time on this podcast talking about the U.S. men's national team. To see Haji Wright continue to emerge as a real legitimate option in the U.S. men's national mm-hmm. team player pool, not even always as a number nine, although he did have some success most recently as a nine for the U.S., but also a little bit wider on the wing, which is again where he was popping up in this game. Second half, got more involved, was able to get forward a little bit in Coventry City as a whole, grew into this game because, let's be honest, they had no other choice. And they were effective. Like, they found little gaps in Manchester United's defensive setup. I mentioned that miscommunication on the Sims goal. It's the first one for Coventry City. Between Dalot and Casemiro, Coventry City do a good job of winning the ball. And then they progress forward quickly, and Dalot's in midfield, which is something we see all over the world, where you've got a defender pushing into midfield. And as he's trying to track back, like, he and Casemiro are just put in a tough spot. And obviously, they don't handle it very well because no one goes and picks up Sims. But it is this incisive, fun bit of attacking play from Coventry City, and to have this game again from a USMNT perspective, at least have regulation end with Haji Wright putting the ball in the back of the net yet again in a big moment in the FA Cup for Coventry is just awesome. So I am truly bummed for them. I'm happy for you, Taylor, but I'm bummed for them to have the penalty shootout go the way that it did, because it felt like there was something there and something awesome that everybody in and around Coventry City would remember for a long time. I still think they will, but they were so close. To being in the final against Man City.
Yeah, big shout out for Coventry in this one, led by Mark Robins, of course, who won the FA Cup as a Manchester United player in 1990. Maybe he replaces Erik ten Hag. We'll see about that one. Probably not, though.
That's the Fergie Fledglings one, right? Where they win that one, and then that's the one that's seen as, like, allowing Fergie to keep the job and then continue on. So there have been many, like, forced comparisons to, well, maybe this is the win that, like, then Ten Hag wins the FA Cup and then they keep him around. I think what you suggested, Ryan, is more likely than the one I'm suggesting.
Yeah, well, Mark Robins saved the club once, Taylor. Arguably, he could save them again.
Hey,
you never know. He could step in.
Bring Haji Wright with him. We need a number nine. Who can
burn away? Indeed. But Coventry, it's important to note, obviously a Championship side, but it's very marginal that they weren't in the Premier League this season. This is the second time they've lost a penalty shootout at Wembley in the past year. Luton getting into the Premier League ahead of them in last year's playoff final as well. So very well done from Coventry indeed. A memory that their fans will have for the rest of their lives, going out and nearly taking on Man United in this game. So congratulations to them, of course. And Man United now have reached the FA Cup final 22 times, the most of any team in the competition. And this one, surely not the sweetest. Anyway, let's go wind it back to Saturday's
Correct.
Action. Yes, indeed. Manchester City will be joining Man United in the FA Cup final for the second year running after a 1-0 win over Chelsea in El Palmerico? El Colico? Still trying to make it happen. I apologise, listener. Bernardo Silva with the 84th minute goal in this one. Redemption for Silva after his penalty in the Champions League a few days before this game. By the way, nice to see Casemiro with a lovely tribute to that Silva penalty in the Man United game by doing the exact same thing and missing against Coventry. Guardiola saying, "I don't understand how we survived today. What they have done today is one of the greatest things I've seen from a group of players." He was complaining, effectively, about the FA Cup semi-final coming 72 hours after a big, big Champions League. Mm-hmm. I mean, Taylor, it's that time of year. That's what happens when fixtures are crunched up like this. He should be used to this.
It is, and he could be used to it. I still understand where he's coming from, because it is a lot to ask. And then on top of that, away from the fixture congestion, just that it's an elimination. It's coming on the heels of elimination from the Champions League, where they are the reigning champions, to be knocked out the way they were. This did feel like it was going to be a bit of a hangover game. I feel like we had a couple of those this weekend, including the one we just discussed. Barcelona maybe looking a little hungover at times. But Chelsea looked very hungover. They looked tired. They looked kind of sluggish.
Nicholas Jackson looked hungover.
Well, yeah, we'll talk about him. But City, for their part, I felt like didn't really start the game in top gear. I'm not sure they ever really found their top gear, and yet they still got the win via Bernardo Silva. As you said, they had some chances. They bring Jeremy Doku in off the bench, and he is that spark that we've come to expect from him. He takes people on. He tries things. He drives at defenders. He makes people uncomfortable in ways that benefit his team. He's involved in the goal, but not overly involved in the goal, I would say. That this is, I think, the quality of Manchester City. While other clubs are complaining about injuries and fixture congestion, and I guess City are doing that as well, they're still able to find a way to win. I think a lot of that has to do with the coaching and the preparation that allows them to maybe carry through even when they are playing at 75% capacity instead of 100% capacity. So credit to them and credit to Pep. Commiserations to Chelsea, because they had chances, man. They looked very good at times and then very wasteful at times.
Very wasteful at times, Joe, would be the headline for me for Chelsea in this game, who probably on the balance of play, apart from putting shots on frame, were the better team, right?
Yeah, except I don't really feel like they had a ton of super high quality chances in this game. Like, you can go and look at some of their shots from distance. You can go and look at some shots from tough angles inside the box. Nicholas Jackson has a nice chance towards the back post. It's, I think, the best chance of the game. That's maybe the one that you look for. But it's not exactly like either team was running rampant in the attack. To me, this game, and Taylor, I sort of had the same reaction as you did when Ryan was mentioning instant classic, because that's the order I had in my head as well, for incorrect reasons, because we obviously did the right thing there. Like, there wasn't a whole lot going on in the final third for either one of these teams. Man City continued to prioritize control over going out there and absolutely blitzing teams, and I don't blame Pep Guardiola for that. It clearly worked in this game, even if he, I think, looking back, would feel that he was a little overly conservative against Real Madrid in the Champions League just a few days earlier. Chelsea sort of do a similar thing in that they don't overextend in this game. They're sitting back in a 4-4-2 shape for most of the match. Getting on the ball, sure, but when they defend, they weren't exactly high pressing, and they didn't end up having, you know, swaths of possession in this game. It was back in a 4-4-2, and it would be often Moises Caicedo or Madueke who would drop into the back line at times to make it a 5. Caicedo was keeping a close eye on Kevin De Bruyne. It was a sort of gritty approach from Pochettino and this Chelsea team. And I thought they executed a lot of it really, really well. Like, every time I watch this Chelsea team, or a lot of the times when I watch this Chelsea team, I look at them and think, how is this team as far down the table as they are? And then I remember games like their chaos match against Manchester United, and it sort of starts to become more clear. But I didn't necessarily think this was a terribly played game from a Chelsea perspective.
Joe, by contrast, I was messaging with a friend of mine who is a Chelsea supporter, and I asked him, because I went back in my notes to early in the season, and I was somewhat impressed by Chelsea under Pochettino when they started. Even if the results weren't going their way, you could see signs that there was intent there. You could see the way they wanted to play. And I had in my notes for one of their first games, when Nicholas Jackson comes good, when he clicks, this team is going to click and score goals. And maybe that's part of it, is that he hasn't fully reached that potential. But I was asking my buddy about his thoughts on Poch, if there's been progress this season. And he said, this is fairly beautiful, so I'm just going to read it verbatim. The lack of excitement and hope for a fan that accompanies Chelsea breaking into the attacking third is such a singular and indefinable thing. I don't know what I can compare it to, that there are presumably a team of professionals whose job it is to hire professionals whose job it is to score involved with Chelsea seems provably untrue, and the proof would be showing someone any match. This FA semifinal is a perfect, FA Cup semifinal is a perfect example. Maybe because winning yesterday and potentially bringing home a very important cup would have indicated major improvements and things to feel good about, and the same old S is the reason that won't happen. We couldn't finish, there was no improvisational skill, but also long stretches where there's seemingly nothing planned or rehearsed either. Also, a 40-year-old plays for us. All of those, I think, are somewhat fair points. I think the interesting thing for me in asking him and a couple of the Chelsea supporters is that they all still want to stick with Poch, that they feel like the issues there aren't necessarily him and that maybe there's no one else better prepared to have an instant impact, but that signing maybe a more proven goal scorer, getting more of the dead weight out of the books, and kind of continuing to build towards a unified approach is the way forward. So though this was not the result they were hoping for, though it was certainly not an instant classic, it does feel like there is frustration, and yet there is at least enough positivity amongst Chelsea supporters that I've spoken to, at least, to continue on and see what happens next season.
There was a perfect summary moment for Chelsea, Taylor, I thought, in this game. 98th minute, when Mudryk had that free kick that ended up in like Rosie of Wembley Stadium, when it should have been floated onto someone's head to force extra time.
I mean, there's that. There's the Chilwell opportunity late when he has Raheem Sterling so open. And if he hits that ball across, you know, it's a difficult ball. You never know what's going to happen once Sterling receives it. But still, that Chilwell just kind of carries and carries and carries and then tries to hit that ball. It's one of the moments where you can hear Raheem Sterling's scream of anguish through the field mics. That's how loud it was because he was so frustrated. It just feels like there isn't that final click. And it's felt that way for a while with Chelsea. Maybe with a few more players added and a few more players shipped out and another maybe preseason under Pochettino, those things click and we see Chelsea return to that top four conversation that we would expect them to be involved in.
Your Chelsea friend who was describing the lack of productivity in the final third in that nicely written message, Taylor, just made me think of the Roy Hodgson gif of the, oh, and his head sinks down. that's very much a Chelsea season. I like that a lot.
Yeah.
I think so. I think the takeaway for me, and I think Joe was right there, though, is that like they still look okay. They still look good. They still look capable of scoring goals at times. It's just not like to the level that maybe it needs to be, or I would have expected it to be at this point, but there is still progress. There are still reasons for optimism, I think, if you are a Chelsea supporter. Certainly a few more of those if you are a Man City supporter.
Yes, indeed. Once again, the Manchester clubs will be meeting in the FA Cup final May 25th, I want to say it is, off the top of my head. Another one, and another one, and another one, Taylor. You never know. You never know. This could... There's been some talking points, Taylor, about Manchester United fans worried they will win this game, and it gives Erik ten Hag the mandate to continue.
That's dumb. I'm much more worried about being beaten 6-0 than I am about Manchester United winning. If they win, maybe they keep ten Hag. Maybe that's the feather in his cap to say this wasn't my fault. They were going to fire me no matter what. But I think there are bigger things to be concerned about if you're a Manchester United supporter. But we've talked plenty about them. Let's talk about other teams, shall we?
Let's move on, shall we? But just to say about the FA Cup, there has been some controversy over the last few days about replays being scrapped in the competition, which for us, you know, from the other side of the Atlantic, looking at the big teams who've got congested fixture lists, it makes sense to have fewer of these games on their plate. But it's been very controversial in England. EFL clubs lower down the pyramid have claimed they've been marginalised by the decision. None were consulted on it. You often get Coventry going as deep as they did. That could be financially huge for them. And for an even smaller team who make a big run, get a replay against the Manchester Uniteds, the Arsenals of this world, that can put them in the black for an entire season or two. So that's not without controversy, even though, Joe, we appreciate that perhaps for players who are tired, like certain Man City players.
Like you said, this is a foreign concept for me as an American sports fan. Is the idea behind the replays being beneficial to the lower league clubs just that you get an extra game against a team that's probably bigger than you, and so you're going to draw more gate revenue?
That's it. And the way the FA Cup revenue is done, it's split 50-50. Mm. So if you're a League Two team and you go to Old Trafford and you get 40,000 people gate receipt, that could, you know, when you usually get 2,000 people come see you, it's
yeah.
huge.
Yeah, man, that is, I see the big club perspective, but that is sad.
Yes. Not an easy answer to that one, but as it is, FA Cup replays have been eliminated. Let's have a quick look around the Premier League. Excuse me. Arsenal staying on top. They're on top in goal difference in the Premier League after a 2-0 win over Wolves at Molineux. Liverpool with a 3-1 win over Fulham. They are joint top behind the aforementioned Arsenal on goal difference after that win at Fulham. Trent with a nice free kick goal in that one if you haven't seen it. And Manchester City 1 point behind with a game in hand over those two. Title race still very much a raging. We had an extremely interesting game, Taylor, at the other end of the table. Everton with a 2-0 win over Nottingham Forest. Interesting. Well, the game was interesting, but just the tweet that Nottingham Forest sent after the game, which I'll read here. Three extremely poor decisions, three penalties not given, which we simply cannot accept. We warned the PGMOL that the VAR is a Luton fan before the game, but they didn't change him. Our patience has now been tested multiple times. NFFC will now consider its options. Your options will probably be to stop tweeting like that and receive your fine for tweeting like that, I imagine.
So I know you're not tossing to me, Ryan, and I didn't see this game, to be fully transparent. If you want to convince people that your perspective is correct and that you're not crazy, this is probably not the way to tweet that, where it sounds like you're just spewing conspiracy nonsense into the world.
This is the ratcheted down tweet. Apparently owner Evangelos Marinakis wanted to personally tweet a way more inflammatory message and had to be convinced that this was the way to go. This was what they settled upon, which has led to a lot of, a la release the Snyder Cut, release the Marinakis tweets. But I don't think we're going to get those because I don't think they want to be fined even more than they already will be. But yeah, they're coming right up to the edge of calling it a conspiracy. I think Nuno after the game said, in another country, we would call this a conspiracy. I don't know what to make of that. But yes, there was a lot of frustration because Stuart Atwell, who was the VAR official for that game, is a Luton fan. Although then arguments have been made that Luton would have benefited from a draw in this one. So that because Nottingham Forest and Everton are both in the relegation zone, Luton not really benefiting from Everton getting 3 points. So that aside, it is worth noting two of the three shouts, I would say, were extremely strong shouts and maybe should have been given. So yeah. I understand where that frustration is coming from. I think there's already frustration for Nottingham Forest with the points deduction. Their appeal on that will be heard later this week. So maybe that gets overturned and they get 4 points back. Maybe not. And that is also part of the conspiracy. But my favorite part of all of this is just learning that this game had come to be known as El Deductico. That is an amazing name for this clash between these two teams.
I can't believe I missed that.
I know. It made me almost as happy as Nottingham Forest alleging that VAR is out to get them because of Luton.
Yeah, it was specifically Stuart Atwell, who was the VAR for this game, accused of being a Luton fan. Sure, Luton had the aforementioned Luton had a 5-1 loss at home to Brentford. They're starting to run out of road now.
It's all part of the plan, Ryan.
It's all we'll see how it all comes together. Somehow this is a massive conspiracy. Burnley, though, with a 4-1 win at Sheffield United. A small glimmer of hope. They have got now their 3 points clear of safety with 4 games left. Crystal Palace with a 5-2 win over West Ham. They're really getting into gear under Oliver Glasner following that win at Anfield last week as well. David Moyes on the rocks after this one, apparently, too. And some more nice work from Aston Villa with a 3-1 win over Bournemouth following their memorable victory away to Arsenal, of course. And, of course, they had a nice week midweek in Europe with their goalkeeper winding up French fans after their shoot-up they had against Lille. They're now 6 points ahead of Tottenham in that race for the Champions League spot. They've played 2 more games, though. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk Bundesliga, we're going to talk MLS and much more back shortly.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer, if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the team's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham, all new, Thursdays on FX, stream on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Total Soccer Show, welcome back, friend. Let's go to the Bundesliga. Bayer Leverkusen's Josip Stanisic scored a 97th-minute goal off a very dramatic corner for the German champions, rescuing a 1-1 draw at Borussia Dortmund, preventing Xabi Alonso's side from suffering their first loss of the season. Taylor, your boys, 80 points from 30 games. They cannot be beat, it seems.
It seems. It felt like they might in this game, and then it was fascinating to me to watch this game and recognize that they do not want to lose this season.
No.
They definitely want to preserve that. Mm. This game was feisty, man. I think one of my big takeaways from it is I didn't know that Leverkusen had that in their bag. Like, not to say that they're soft or anything like that, but there were a lot of physical challenges, a lot of players getting knocked down. Jeremy Frimpong gets knocked down like 7 or 8 times pretty hard. One of them leads to a scrum and a lot of shoving and players falling over that briefly led to a red card to Victor Boniface before that was overturned through VAR. Instead, it's a yellow card to, surprisingly, Granit Xhaka is the one who's involved in the fray who pulls Nico Schlotterbeck down. But there was a lot of physicality to this game. And I think if you're Bayer Leverkusen, who have the league wrapped up, they could be forgiven. And I do wonder if they had already lost a game, if maybe they think, nah, that's fine. We're okay to lose this game. We've got it all wrapped up. But instead, they make really aggressive changes, I would say. They bring in Schick and Boniface at the exact same time. So you bring on two forwards. You bring on Florian Wirtz, who ends up getting the assist off that corner. And they really go for it. And they really worked hard to get that equalizer. And when they did, it's a bench-clearing celebration at the corner flag. It is emphatic celebrations. It is clear that they really, really would like to go this entire season undefeated.
Yeah, it was indeed. Joe, I wonder if there's an element of Borussia Dortmund support who look at Bayer Leverkusen and think, this should be us.
Yep.
We had the ingredients to do this. Why isn't this us?
Yeah, I mean, Leverkusen have nailed basically everything this year and I think have become the envy of every other team in the Bundesliga not named Bayern Munich, and even including Bayern Munich in their own different yep. sort of special way. Like, they're the prize right now in German soccer. They're one of the most entertaining teams and one of the best teams to watch in all of Europe, and one of the most effective actually on the field as well. To do what they've done is so incredibly difficult. We've talked so many times in the past about how far ahead it's felt like Bayern Munich had been, because they have been, and they faltered some more recently, Bayern, when it comes to their transfer approach. But Leverkusen seem to have found an incredible mixture of talents, both young and up-and-coming, and players like Granit Xhaka, who have come over and already had really high-level European experience, but still have something left to give. They've managed to combine basically not missing on a single transfer, or at least not a high-profile one, with going out there and identifying and giving time to a manager in Xabi Alonso, who looks like he might be one of the few at the highest levels of the European game that has like a real outsized impact over some of his peers. Like, that is so incredibly hard to do. So I don't blame Dortmund or anybody for looking and thinking, man, I wish that was us. But going out there and actually executing, it's a completely different story.
Joe, were you struck by the physicality of this one?
Yes.
And how much Leverkusen fought? Because, again, that was just, I don't know why that was surprising, but it was.
No, I was struck by that, but honestly, more so in the celebrations after the late equalizer.
Yeah.
Rather than in some of the scraps. And it's fun as a like, you know, casual fan of all these teams to go and see a little dust up now and then. Like, I'm here for that. Mm-hmm. But it really was Xabi Alonso's reaction after that late equalizer. And this is coming on the heels of Leverkusen getting a late equalizer in the Europa League against West Ham. In a game, like, that goal didn't matter, right? For really any real reason, that goal didn't matter because they were already going to advance. They were up 2-1 on aggregate. That goal put them up 3-1 late in the 89th minute in the Europa League. Like, they were going to be in the semifinals one way or the other. But this team cares. Like, this team wants to make more history than what they've made so far. And this, honestly, the reaction from Xabi, the reaction from this team, was maybe my favorite thing from the weekend.
Yep.
To see how much that they want to go out there and be undefeated for an entire season's worth of games. I don't know if they're going to do it. Roma in the Europa League semis is not an easy draw. Like, this is a difficult path for them to finish this thing out strong. But getting a result against Dortmund was also not an easy thing for this team. And they haven't had an easy season, yet they continue to win.
That Europa League fixture will be the two candidates for manager of the season, in my mind. We'll see how that one plays out. Joe, I'm really glad that you highlighted Xabi Alonso there for a moment.
No way you just said that.
Quietly, I did. We'll talk more about it maybe on the Patreon. But Xabi Alonso runs down the sideline, gets into the scrum to celebrate, and then as the players are continuing to celebrate, he thinks about trying to restore order. You can see him start to be like, hey, we got to get back, and then just says like, nah, and gives it like the big up to the crowd, then goes jogging back. And I think my favorite moment is that as he's jogging back by himself, it's just so clear that he like then processes the moment again and can't help but he does another little like jump fist bumps, like fist pump celebration, like, and jumps up in the air and does it. And it's just like, no one is around him, he's just so pumped up from this result. You can just see the enthusiasm, the exuberance there. That was lovely. For Dortmund, I would say the opposite is true. I don't fully know how to take this one. Mats Hummels at the end of the game took it angrily. He throws the ball into his chest. I don't know what he was trying to demonstrate there, but in front of the officials, he threw the ball into his chest and then volleyed it into the crowd. A protest of sorts, one would assume. But it's a Dortmund team that I thought looked good against a very dominant Bayer Leverkusen team, or a Leverkusen team that's been dominant this season. And Dortmund don't create many chances. I think their XG is like 0.5 or something like that for this one, but it's a great goal from Nicklas Fulkrug. It's off a throw-in. It's some clever interplay. It's Julian Brandt with a little like Billy Baldwin flick, as we call it, and then it's a good ball across from Fulkrug to volley home in pretty emphatic fashion. And it felt like this could be an important result for Dortmund as they remain alive in the Champions League, and especially since they are chasing that final Champions League spot in the Bundesliga. And again, it feels like a microcosm for the season that they're playing well, they're hanging with this team who have been so good for so long, they're getting a goal, they're fighting tooth and nail, the home crowd is behind them, and then with almost the final kick of the ball, they concede an equalizer. And it feels like for all of that effort, there's still that one letdown, there's still that inefficiency, there's still that lack of control that lets teams back in. And it has to be really frustrating for Dortmund supporters to not only drop those 2 points, but to have that continued feeling that at any moment it could go wrong, we might make a mistake, who knows what's going to happen. I don't think that's what you want as you head into a Champions League semifinal.
The old Dortmund roller coaster never change. Hey. Bayern Munich with a 5-1 win over Union Berlin. Harry Kane with a goal and assist in that one. Union have now lost 3 on the bounce, 3 points above the drop zone now. Oy boy. But for Bayern, Taylor, I don't know if you saw, Harry Kane and Manuel Neuer had a selfie, which is on the Bayern Instagram, with Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. So no trophy, but hey, they got to meet, you know, Hollywood darlings.
Oh, yeah, they have that strange movie coming out that involves a stunt person and a director, and I don't quite know what to make of it. I saw the trailer before Dune 2, and it made me do this with my head while watching it. So there you go. That's what I have to say about that.
Blunt and Gosling are delightful, Taylor, so I'll probably go watch it on the strength of them alone.
Joe and David and I were talking about some of our favorite SNL sketches of recent memory. Specifically, David and I were just giving him a list to watch.
Yeah, they then proceeded to send me like 30 texts in our little three-person group chat that we use to plan the shows and talk about random MLS stuff. I looked down at my phone. Actually, I was getting coffee with somebody, and I get like bzz, 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 and I don't want to check my phone, right, because I'm trying to have a real conversation, and it just keeps going, and afterwards I look, and it was David and Taylor sending me sketch after sketch.
Yeah, and there's more for me to send, Joe. I did not send you one of my favorites, which is the Ryan Gosling Papyrus one, which they recently had a sequel to. That might be my favorite sketch in a very long time, and the sequel is pretty incredible as well. So that alone makes me love Ryan Gosling, and then him breaking 14,000 times in the most recent episode also makes me love him. We should talk about soccer, though, instead of SNL.
I'm sorry, the slight giggle he does during every sketch makes it for me, Taylor. Yes. Yeah, wonderful. Yes. But let's talk about soccer, shall we? Real quick, let's go to Joe Lowry's MLS corner. California Clasico, Joe, just the 5, 6, 7 goals in that one.
Yeah, just such a casual, easy way to end the weekend. To peel back the curtain, every weekend I do a write-up on every single team in the Western Conference or backheel. Ben Wright does the Eastern Conference. So this was the last game. Like, I had my article pretty much ready to go otherwise. And the Galaxy hop out to a 3-0 lead. And I'm thinking, like, oh, man, this thing's going to be so easy to write. Like, the Galaxy dominating in the attack. Their defensive issues didn't show for once. And then they somehow have this incredible ability, the Galaxy, to turn every game into a nail-biter. And it was 4-3 in the final whistle. So much fun this game, though. And I love that the Quakes got a little bit of action here. I know this feels like a cheap compliment. You know, it's fun. You guys scored a few goals. That's good. Life is bad for San Jose. And life in the attack, at least for the Galaxy, is absolutely unbelievable. This team is as close to must-watch as I think any MLS team gets. All three of the P's, the killer P's, get a goal in this game. Painsil, Peck, Puig. Like, Pooch, excuse me, I don't know what happened there. There's so much quality in this team going forward. There's chaos at the back end. Eric Zavaleta, like, just straight up drags down Jeremy Obobese for the penalty in the second half. There's just so many stupid things that happen in every LA Galaxy game, and I love it so much. They're so much fun. That Cali Clasico was maybe my favorite game of the MLS season so far. There were other great games, though, this weekend. There was a 6-goal thriller between SKC and St. Louis City. St. Louis getting a goal in second half stoppage time to rescue a point on the road. We're seeing Peter Vermees continue to play with this 4-2-3-1 shape. We're seeing both of these teams struggle to defend at the other end and to defend either in transition or in a set moment. We saw João Klaus absolutely body Willy Agata into the next district in the first half of this match that ends with the Celio Pompeo goal in stoppage time in that first 45. So much to like in this game. I don't think either one of these teams, St. Louis or Sporting Kansas City, are particularly good. Maybe we'll talk more about them tomorrow. But if you're looking for action, you know, you can't do a whole lot better than that. Lionel Messi and into Miami top Nashville SC. They win that game 3-1. Even though Nashville played pretty well, it's another example of if you give Miami an inch, they're going to take a mile on you. And the last game that I'll highlight before, Ryan, I want to get your take on Charlotte FC against Minnesota United. You can talk more about your guitar if you want, Ryan. You can take that one wherever you want to go. I watched it, so I've got some thoughts on it if you don't. But RSL on the road in Chicago topped the Fire 4-0. I believe this was tied for the worst home loss in Chicago Fire history. I'd have to go double-check that stat. It's up on the site somewhere. But, like, this has gotten to historically bad levels in Chicago right now. Zerdan Shaqiri comes off in the 28th minute of this game with an injury. Brian Gutierrez was injured in warm-ups. And you go and watch this team, if you think, okay, well, they lose their two sort of best playmakers in the attacking midfield line, they'll probably just set up shop and go out there and try to control some of the game. They don't really do that. They let in three goals in the first 37 minutes of this game. Chicho Arango and RSL are flying right now. You go and watch the last goal that Diego Luna scores in second half stoppage time for RSL. And Chicago just look broken. Like, they can't get pressure to the ball. They look completely broken in this match. And I think they are. Like, as a roster, as a team, Frank Lopez was an uninspiring hire. There's so much more that we could do on the Fire. Maybe, again, we'll do some of that tomorrow. But, like, the Fire are in bad shape. And the fact that I'm highlighting them in a league where the Quakes haven't lost. I haven't won but just one game so far. The Revs are looking very, very poor. FC Dallas has a whole bucket full of problems. The fact that we're talking about Chicago, I think, says something.
Indeed. Yeah, Joe, the Charlotte FC game against Minnesota, a 3-0 win for Minnesota on the road there. I'd like to get your perspective, actually, because maybe I'm a bit too biased, but for me, it wasn't a terrible performance from Charlotte. There was a lot of the Chelsea-esque failing in the final third, lots of aimless crosses coming in without being met. Like, there was a little bit of a chance, basically with an open goal early on, which I think really would have changed the game had that been put in the back of the net. And that level of performance was better for me, certainly as a spectacle, than anything we saw last year, arguably.
Yeah, I think the ceiling of this team is still fairly low, but the floor, I think, is very clearly higher this year than it was last year, which is sort of what you're saying there, Ryan. Like, even when the final third play isn't super sharp, and it wasn't in this game for Charlotte, they were certainly the second best team on the field against Minnesota. But it maybe wasn't tragically awful. I don't think we're going to see many tragically awful games from Dean Smith and the Charlotte FC team. They're too well structured for that, in that they
have
a structure. Well, like, I don't know. Then you look at the other end, and Leo Labada is the most fun attacking player on this team. The highest level he's played at is in Scotland. He's still a young player. He's still only a few games into his MLS career. It's going to take time for him to grow, and I think Charlotte very clearly need one more attacking piece for them to be a real threat in the Eastern Conference. But I do sort of take your point, Ryan. They weren't all the way played off the field. I do want to give credit to Minnesota United, who are dealing with all the Emmanuel Reynoso craziness. Eric Ramsey comes out and changes his shape in this game and goes with a 3-4-3 that we haven't seen for any sustained period of time for Minnesota under Ramsey so far this season. He drops Timu Pukki and Bongi Hwanglane and starts Tani Oluwaseyi, who was on loan with San Antonio last year in the USL Championship and was brilliant. I got to watch him in person against Phoenix. He was tearing dudes up in the second division and has kind of just been doing the exact same thing in MLS. He scores in this game. Few players, you know, experienced, new to the league, whatever. Few players in Major League Soccer are as good at slashing him behind the back line as Tani is. He's got three goals in very limited minutes this year. I still don't really know what to make of Minnesota United to look at them, because they're dealing with the Reynoso chaos and because Ramsey's so new. Feels like there's a lot of moving pieces and parts. But if they can keep getting these kinds of results and unearthing talents like Tani, then maybe they're cooking a little bit in the Western Conference.
Yeah, they look solid, and I thought their back line was pretty solid. It dealt with everything that Charlotte threw their way. There was a guy, Joe, in a Timu Pukki Norwich shirt in my section, which I liked and also didn't like simultaneously. Didn't know how to feel about it.
I think that checks out. I think I saw a clip that Dean Smith and Pukki were having a little chat pregame, like maybe just getting over some PTSD from being relegated in the Premier League and, like, you know, talking through all that stuff. Guys, we can't be relegated here. This is the best league in the world. I think that's what they were talking about.
That's probably it. That was probably the conversation. Yeah. All right, weekend, you have pretty much been reviewed, but we have some bonus material. Patreon.com/TotalSoccerShow, where we're going to be doing weekend review extra. We're going to be talking about the Serie A title race as we record, which is not yet decided. Might be in a few hours' time. We've got some news updates on Paris Saint-Germain. Vitesse Arnhem are in a bit of trubs, Taylor. Oh dear. And plenty more to come. I want to talk about your take about Daniel De Rossi being manager of the season for his half season that he's managed so far.
And you will all come around.
All right.
I'm just going to say it now. I will not. But I'm excited nonetheless.
Indeed, as am I. But for now, Joe Lowry, thank you very much for your wonderful analysis on this here pod.
Keep on shredding, baby.
Indeed, I shall. Taylor, you keep on shredding, darling.
You do the same, my friend.
Listener, you keep on shredding the mostest. We'll be back on the feed very shortly. More MLS and much more American soccer coming on the feed on Tuesday's episode. But for now, bye!